All right, we're going to go ahead and call the reboot meeting, informal committee thing together. Let's see, we have some new members that are joining us from our endeavors last year. How I'd like to proceed is I'd like to kind of discuss the recommendations that the reboot committee made last year and presented, probably ask some questions of various interested party members, stakeholders, government agencies on where those things are at, and probably open it up for discussion amongst the panel. Keep this very informal. One thing is we will probably, last time we just called for input from those in the audience. Raise your hand. We'll gladly call on you. We do have a book of emails that we would like to go through. Last time we went through every single email, which proved to be very fruitful. But before we get into that, I want to go through the issues from last year. So, committee members, anyone have any opening statements or anything, any questions before we proceed? All right, very good. All right, last year we had a list on the social services of about 12 different taxpayer savings ideas that would range from 79 to 117 million. We could save the taxpayers, the state. The first was the state rehabilitation center reform. The recommendation from last year's panel was to close some centers and transition clients to community-based care, exploring moving some clients to centers to a community waiver, which could save up to $100 a day. This could be done internally, is what we were told by the departments, and the estimated savings was anywhere from 9 to 20 million. I do believe some legislation has been filed to do this over a five-year period. I think the initial fiscal note on that bill is coming in somewhere around $16 million is what the savings would be if they were to be achieved over a five-year period. Basically, the idea was behind this one, just to clarify for those people that were not on the committee last year, was that no new people are being admitted into the habitation centers. So the front door basically has been closed. And due to the age, the medical frailness of the population, it is basically expected within 10 years that population will basically shrink on its own due to aging out of life expectancy. So that being said, if we're spending on some HAB centers of upwards of $550 a day, then when you shrink that population, the structural costs of the rehabilitation centers will maintain, and so therefore if you have less people, the costs are still there. These $550 a day individuals could easily start costing $750 a day, $850 a day, because the static costs stay the same or rise, and you have less people being served. So at some point, these, in my opinion, will close on their own due to the aging out. The problem that we had is a fiscal crunch last year. We had one of the centers was going to be closed. Short-term notice was given to the families and those care members that were there. And within several weeks, they were finding out that they were going to have to move. So the idea was that if we know this day is coming, we know it's going to save this taxpayer's money, we should plan ahead for it, create transition plans when this day comes, and then have a end game goal. It really is not a anti- one type of a group versus a pro-community type of a group. It's just basically we see this happening on its own and we're trying to plan ahead. And if we can realize fiscal savings in the bad budget years by planning ahead, that was the intention of that recommendation. It was the number one most recommended thing via the emails into the system last year. Committee members, anyone have any questions on that recommendation and where it stands? I won't lie, it's a political hot button. It will make a lot of people upset, but it's one of those that we need to discuss. So anyone in the audience like to comment on last year's recommendation, which I do know there is legislation pending? All right. Well, I figured that would take 45 minutes. The next one was the state's False Claims Act. This is basically government Medicaid fraud. Legislation would be required. The savings was unknown. Can anyone from the department speak on where, if this has gotten any legs, what the estimated savings would be if any legislation has been filed this session. Could you please come up to the mic, state your name?
We need witness forms.
Yes. I'm being told no, yes. No. Do you want to fill out a witness form? You can. Whether in, no, very good.
On? Okay, sorry. The False Claims Act was filed last year by Senator Schmidt. He filed two bills. One was compliant with the Federal False Claims Act, and the other focused not so much on the compliance issue, but just getting a False Claims Act. And the first bill, the one that was federally compliant, received a hearing, Senate hearing, and didn't progress any further than that.
Do we know what the fiscal note was on the savings, anticipated savings?
Between $1 and $3 million.
Okay.
For social services.
And do you know, has anything been filed?
I don't believe anything's been filed, but I know there are some folks working on it.
Okay, and give me a brief overview of what it does.
What it does is it allows whistleblowers to file claims and receive a percentage back from the claim. That's basically, in a nutshell, what it does.
And you generated the $1 to $3 million savings because you think there would be an incentive for those to root out fraud, waste, and abuse?
Correct.
And I'm assuming that many states have this. I remember reading. How many states do you know out of 50?
For some reason, 20 so sticks out in my mind, but that's something I can check on.
And what would be a reason that someone would say this is the worst thing that we could possibly do?
I think there's a concern that it will result in over-reporting, incorrect reporting by some people, and that some things that would really be errors would be reported.
And I'm sure that the 20 states that do that have experienced this, as the department looked into what their false claims are on a percentage of the total number of claims that other states that have had this for a while.
I don't know, but we can check.
That would be wonderful. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Missouri already has a False Claims Act. I know because it was part of the MoHealthNet reform bill in 2007, and I handled that bill in the House. And the version that we currently have says that if a person sees something that's fraudulent going on, that person can report that to the state attorney general, and the state attorney general can vet the case, file such an action under the False Claims Act, and recover damages, and then share those damages with the person who made the reporting. So there's already the incentive there. Now, the incentive for Missouri to pass a tighter act would be that Missouri would then get to share in a little higher slice of the money that the federal government recovered under the False Claims Act, because most of the money, if it's a 60-40 split under Medicaid between the federal government and the state government, then, the federal government would share just a little higher slice with Missouri. But unfortunately, what's not taken into account is that if you make it so that the federal government would be willing to do that, what you'll be doing is creating a situation where every attorney in Missouri now will have the ability to file this lawsuit and then put all of the providers in Missouri at higher risk of being sued in a way that the cases wouldn't be vetted by the attorney general. And what that's going to result in is a lot more frivolous lawsuits against providers, which is going to jack up the cost of liability insurance. And that's going to raise the cost of health care. And that is something that we don't want to do because it will end up costing the state more. and it will put less money in the pockets of employers. They're going to have to ultimately pay that increased cost. That's going to end up putting people out of work. That's so
right. Excellent viewpoints.
This is a bad idea, Mr.
Barry,
Chairman.
Barry, this is why we're having these meetings, because a lot of the ideas last year came from one afternoon of work. So here we are trying to revisit a lot of those. Anyone else like to comment on the State False Claims Act or provide a different viewpoint or echo any of the comments that have already been said? Everyone agree with Dr. Schaaf? Representative, Senator, Doctor? Does anybody think he's full of hooey? Wow. This is a quiet audience today. Last year, they were much more rambunctious. Okay, we'll move right along. Bringing all Medicaid eligibles under managed care statewide. I have a feeling that we might discuss this one. Estimated savings, $23 million. Is anyone here from the governor's office, from their budget, Linda Lubring, or anyone from her office? Okay. Anyone here from the departments? Is the $23 million savings still in the ballpark? I've heard numbers of $160 million. I've heard numbers of $8 million. Really focus how much GR could possibly be saved. And I understand if you carve out nursing homes, you carve out pharmacy, you carve out all those things. But assuming in a perfect world we just did this, didn't carve anyone out, we did the ABD population, we did specialty care, we did everything, what would the department estimate a savings would be? Is that on?
I'm Jennifer Tidball with the Department of Social Services. I think I'm going to talk about two groups separately. How we've talked about it is expanding managed care to the current populations where we have managed care in the I-70 corridor and a little bit north and south of Kansas City and St. Louis. In those particular populations, I know like the 30 to 40 million, the 23 million, some of the savings, we actually had Mercer do a study for us last year. That study was a little bit different than asking the question, well, it was different than asking the question, what would managed care save us? The question was, what costs have we avoided in that I-70 corridor or the north and south by having managed care? And so what would the cost have been if those individuals would have been in a fee-for-service setting versus managed care? It sounds like the same question, but when you start to work with an actuary, quite honestly, it's not the same question.
So you're basically trying to identify how much managed care saved rather than saying
right.
If you did this and
right.
The other, you can't
expanding.
Take.
And because there are different populations when you start to look outside of that I-70 corridor, and the communities are much different.
And what are the Mercer?
We actually did have Mercer do some additional work for us looking at if we expanded this the current population that we have in managed care in the I-70 corridor. And
is
frankly,
that report public yet?
I don't know if it's public or not. I can check on that. I don't know what
members.
We could release publicly. But I can tell you the results were that there's really not a substantial budget impact. It's a cost neutral decision, and so it really becomes, frankly, more of a policy discussion than a budget discussion.
So when you're saying it's a cost neutral, it's not a immediate cost to the state. There's not a savings to the state, but is the growth going to be in the in the expense of that population going to be smaller, like you had seen in the Mercer study on the I-70 corridor? Or are you looking at it just in the fiscal impact to the state budget, not the savings on the cost of what it could have increased over the future?
I believe it was the fiscal. I might have Marga come up. Marga Helscher, she's been working more, frankly, with Mercer than I have. She might be able to add some additional information.
Sorry, Senator, can you restate your question for me?
I've heard there's new numbers out from Mercer and the study. Was it designed just to look at the immediate cost to from a state budget perspective in these next couple of years, or was it trying to identify, like the original study did, on what the savings were by implementing it? And so are we looking at, yeah, there might not might be a budget neutral thing, but are there savings in the future because the inflation in this population won't be as high if you had managed care versus fee-for-service.
Right, whether the trend is reduced, like you have an off-trend savings. Actually, Senator, what we did is we asked Mercer to take a look and give us the next few years, like your the initial year in implementing a managed care product and then or expanding that and then the next year as well. We didn't really have them go out and say and do 5 years from now. So what we got from them was basically the first year of implementation and then the second year.
Was there an increased cost to the state in the first year due to upfront costs?
Yes.
And do you know what that was?
I would have to go back and revisit that study because you're talking about the expansion population. The reason why there's an increased cost in that initial year is if you think about how managed care works, we have lag claims coming in from the prior year and from the fee-for-service population. When you convert those that population into a managed care model, we're paying both. We're paying capitation payments for the managed care plans, and then we're also paying those lag payments from the fee-for-service.
So you're paying 13 months in a 12-month year.
13 to 14. It depends on, I mean, you're paying those claims that for dates of service prior to moving to the new model.
Okay. And
that's why those first years are it's kind of expensive.
Is that just a accounting cost because you're because you got the cost coming? Would you pick that up on the back end if we were to look at? So is it just what year it's counted versus an overall cost to the state? Because would there be savings on the end if you ended the program? Then you wouldn't have that, and then so on a big picture, would those upfront costs even out? And it's just when you look at a 2-year period.
Yeah, I'm not for sure without thinking that through.
Well, I guess my thought is we would have residual fee-for-service claims for a couple up to 2 months, like we talked about, plus we would have 12 months of capitated payments. Then in the second year, you would still have 12 months of capitated payments. So it's a one-time cost to the state to convert to. I mean, that's that the residual claims, the fee-for-service claims, is a one-time cost to convert to managed care. But I believe based on the 2-year study, still in that second year, it was still a cost. It was cost. I mean, there weren't savings identified in that expansion population.
Now, are we talking about the existing pie? So if we were to go to managed care for this statewide, whatever, and then we were to have, you know, capitated rate, additional people that come onto the system we'd have to have a supplemental budget to pay for those, or is the contract we award to XYZ to manage this, do they absorb the new people coming in, or does the state have to increase the payment because there's X new people coming into the system if it grows?
Yeah, the contracts are written where it's dependent upon the number of lives that they cover. So as we have caseload growth, we would need to, just like on our fee-for-service program, you would increase the appropriation authority. We would need the appropriation authority increase to cover those lives.
Oh, for new people, okay.
For new people.
That was perfect. So then let's say there's an inflationary cost into healthcare, and you have a 3-year contract with a managed care company. Is the state locking in the rates for that fixed population, not including if new people come on? Are they locking in that for 3 years, or is it can the company come back and say, well, healthcare costs went up X percent, so therefore we get an increased payment from the state?
Senator, we lock that rate in for the year. And managed care rates have to be actuarially sound. So that's where we have the actuaries come, and you know they do the studies for us, and they'll tell us what the trend should be on cost. But that rate is locked into an annual. It's for 1 year.
So let's say you sign a 3-year contract with XYZ company to provide managed care in the state. You're only locking in your rates for 1 year, and then you have to...
Yes.
And is it a negotiation with the managed care company, or is it direct with CMS and say this is what it actuarially has to be and then this is what they get? And what factors go into that? And what is the risk to the state on the increase in that second year? Is it just inflation in health care?
It's primarily inflation in health care and what the plans are experiencing their cost. And we do, you know, CMS, we do have to provide our rates. Like it, when we go out for, I think April 1, we'll send out the new contract rates. And I have to go back and check the dates. But for next fiscal year, when that happens, we are required to send those rates to CMS for their approval. So to make sure that they're actuarially sound.
So do you, are you... So theoretically, the savings from managed care, where does it come from? Does it come from the inflationary cost of health care in the future isn't growing as quick because you're managing it better, or where is the savings coming from?
Primarily, I think it's traditional. It's like utilization. They manage. If you think about our fee for service population. We don't have the case managers that, say, a managed care company would have. So I think it's managing utilization.
So if we had, so in the fee-for-service
and preventative care
model,
I mean,
and then every year the inflationary costs go up, and we have to have our, what the rates are by CMS, or this is what you pay for this type of a service. So whether or not you have managed care or fee-for-service, is that piece changing at all when you figure out what your rates are going to be?
We change. I'm sorry, Senator. We do change our rates as a result of a trend, if it's warranted by the actuary. I mean, if the actuary comes back and says that we need a trend for our managed care rates, then we would go through the appropriations process and ask for a trend, bring it to the General Assembly, and then for action. I don't know that I answered your question.
I'm not even sure what
I
even asked. So.
I'm sorry.
I'm just trying to see where in the if I have two states that have the exact same population, the exact same cost, and one has managed care, one doesn't, is their second year of operation, are they going to see the same costs increase, assuming the exact same population did the exact same thing? What am I going to see as far as my future costs when, if I have to go back every year and have actuarially sound rates? What is the benefit for?
And you're comparing a state that has managed care to another state that has managed care?
No, let's say we cloned Missouri.
Uh-huh.
We had fee for service and exactly it is now with the managed care on the corridor, and then we went statewide managed care for everything. And the exact same people went to the exact same doctors in this parallel universe. Mm-hmm. Year two and three, when I have to go back and have actuarially sound rates on the managed care side, and then you're looking at your trends on the fee-for-service side, and you have to come back, am I going to see the same numbers, or am I going to see a differentiated number based off of a lower theoretical cost like you have seen through the Mercer study on the I-70 corridor of what the savings was by the lower?
I would, yeah, I'm not sure, Senator, without having the actuaries take a look at it. I would suspect, I mean, you know, our fee-for-service population, we're not providing any increases to the rates. We're holding that steady. It would depend on whether a trend or what the costs were on the managed care side. But we have, you know, and offsetting the utilization. So it would just depend on, you know, on the assumptions there and what we require in the contracts, because we have really tightened up our contracts with managed care plans where we're requiring them to do. We've put in adjustments, risk efficiency adjustments to limit their, you know, that we're only paying for appropriate care. I mean, not that we were ever not paying for appropriate care, but to manage those contracts.
Question. Oh, the new Mercer numbers that are out had something to do with that, and I can't remember. Does anyone else have any questions? Yeah. Go right ahead.
Yeah, actually, my question was along the same line as the senator. And I guess what I'm looking at is what our our benefits would be, not 2 or 3 years down the line, but what our economic benefits would be 10 years down the line. And so I know that's a huge question, and it will involve a lot of forecast and smart, intelligent people. But if we are looking at, and I'll just use that example, if we're looking at two states, and there's one state, make-believe Missouri, and then there's the Missouri, and there's Missouri that chose to get into this fully, and the other that didn't, at the end of 10 years, which state is going to be better off? And that's the question that I'm pursuing here. And, I mean, do you have any insight? It seems as though you can't see beyond 2 or 3 years, but is there anyone who can answer that question? What is the difference 10 years down the line, and what is the true savings, and is it worth it?
Yeah, I don't know 10 years down the line how that would be, where we would be, which would be more beneficial. One of the things that, you know, also when you're comparing state to state, you have to compare what benefits they've carved out, you know, for example, what they include in their managed care. There's all kinds of assumptions in the way that managed care plans can be they can be modeled in any state. So, yeah. No, Senator, I'm sorry, I don't know.
So when we're dealing with the inflation, I'm really concerned about these contracts as well, because in these contracts, if we're not really looking at how they're put together, that growth over time cannot produce a save. It may not provide the savings that we're actually looking for, and. I mean, is there anything that have not put in place yet that you're looking at? Are there any other states that provide an example for you of a best practice to reduce overall cost over time?
We constantly work with our actuary to get what are best practices or what's going on in other states to limit cost for our managed care plans and how we develop those contracts. We've recently implemented risk efficiency rates where we limit the amount of spend for avoidable hospital admissions, for example. And so that was just implemented last year. We'll continue. This is year two. So we're constantly doing things like that. This year we've worked with the plans. They know we've done an admin review, an administrative review, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't paying more in administration costs than what we should. So we've asked Mercer to take a look at that. We've got plan-specific information there that they're reviewing, and there will be a reduction in the rates. We'll lower the rates based on their findings. So we do take those actions, and we do ask them, you know, the actuaries every year to give us examples of ways that we in Missouri can manage our contracts better or work with the plans to make sure that we're paying the lowest possible amount in our contracts.
And my last question or request is, when the Mercer report is available, it would be really great if all the members can have a copy of that.
Senator Schaaf. Proceed.
Do you have the Mercer draft report in your possession? Not here, but have you had an opportunity to read it?
Yes, I mean, Representative, it was not as much of a report. It's more of a letter to me that gave me the cost increases. It wasn't really a report like what you may have been familiar with that was prepared for the Oversight Committee. It wasn't anything like that.
Okay, well, I was informed that there was a draft report, and is that what you're talking about, the
yes.
letter to you?
It's a draft letter.
And can we share that? Can we see
mm-hmm.
that letter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and does that letter say, I was told that that draft report said that there would be a zero benefit to the state moving moms and kids from statewide to managed care. Is that
yes, that's
correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I would like to have that so that I could look at it. And the next thing is, I understand that Oklahoma went from having managed care to doing all of their management in-house. And have you seen the report on that and how it turned out that doing it in-house actually saved money in Oklahoma?
No, sir, I haven't.
Okay. Have you ever done a study of any potential savings with just eliminating managed care for the I-70 corridor completely to see if that would save the state money and bringing those managed care services in-house?
No, we haven't. Like Jennifer explained earlier, the analysis that we've done there was basically cost avoidance model, not necessarily what it would save.
Right, but there is the potential, isn't there, that the state could save money by simply going to doing the management in-house instead of contracting it out.
Senator, I think we would still get into that same year one issue where we're paying, in that case, we would be paying a capitated payment as well as a fee-for-service amount.
Well, if
possibly.
You went to...
I don't know, Senator. We would have to look at it. We would have to look at it.
You remember when we went through the Health Net reform process back in 2007? We put into the bill, it was Senate Bill 577, we put in that everyone would be in a health improvement plan and that it would either have to be a managed care company, a capitated plan, or an ASO, administrative services organization model, or fee-for-service, and that everyone would have to be in to one of those plans. And then the department, through the Health Net Oversight Committee, was supposed to do a study, and it was to be done by a certain year, and to see whether or not doing it through an ASO model or doing it through a managed care model, whichever one of those was most efficient, or maybe even fee-for-service, and then recommend to the General Assembly which one worked. We haven't progressed along that timeline, have we? We have never done that. We don't have anybody in an ASO.
Don't have anything on an ASO.
Right. And so everything that we had planned back then, you know, we're still waiting. You know, we haven't gotten any data to tell us whether an ASO would work better or whether managing it in-house, much like we do through the chronic care improvement plan that we have in-house. Don't you think that we ought to proceed on with that before we just put everybody on managed care, and which might actually cost us money? At least we have a study that shows that there's no benefit. I mean, it seems to me that might be the way to go. Any thoughts on that?
I think Senator, a couple of the studies that were presented to the Oversight Committee last year started down that path, as far as there was an Alicia Smith and Associates study that was done to look at more quality measures between managed care and fee-for-service. And then I mentioned earlier the study that looked at cost avoidance by having managed care in the I-70 corridors. And I think those were two studies to start down that path, I would say. And I frankly haven't been part of the Oversight Committee, so I don't know how those progressed in the Oversight Committee.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, are we discussing just only the item, bring all Medicaid eligibles, or are we only talking about moms and kids right now? Three and four. So is it fair game to talk about the ABD population here? Okay. You know, I've got some real concerns about putting the ABD population on managed care. And is it not true that your Mercer report suggests that in the first year there is no savings and probably a cost to putting ABD on there?
That's correct, Senator. The testimony I had given earlier had been intended to just talk about the expansion of the current population moving into the ABD. You're right that I believe the information that we have is that Mercer would estimate a cost the first year. A lot of that is around the thought that there is possibly pent-up demand, and so that when individuals in that population, the ABD population, have access to services that maybe they don't have, frankly, under the fee-for-service model right now, that they would take advantage of those services in a managed care model, and the managed care companies would possibly would have an incentive to do that as far as from a preventative standpoint and getting those individuals well. Looking ongoing at that study down the road when we had a more stable program, there could be some savings. And we're talking probably year three, year four. Of 14 and a half million GR is right now what the estimated savings is, and quite frankly, the reason that that's not more is that we have a lot of other funds that support the Medicaid program besides general revenue that we would save those funds that couldn't necessarily be reinvested into the Medicaid program. The other thing that I wanted to say on ABD was that as far as that is as a care, I mean, managed care is one care management model. One of the things that we're in the infancy stages or that we're working on as a department with the Department of Health is a healthcare home model for individuals that looks differently and frankly is a newer model than managed care that looks differently or works with that particular population, the Department of Mental Health population. And so we're also looking at other care management models that that are, frankly, newer and just different than managed care. And
would that model, would the healthcare home model handled in-house then? It wouldn't be handled by a managed care company, correct?
No, Senator. My understanding is like a healthcare home model, or that model. We would be trying to work with individual providers that meet the criteria for that medical home, and so then we would be paying those providers, whether it be provider-based rural health clinic, a rural health clinic, an FQHC, just any, or a physician's office, a practice that can meet those the criteria that's
Have you put a line required. Item in the budgeting process in for this healthcare home model up to this point in the budget process?
We don't have anything in our department request.
Okay.
We're still developing and working on that.
You wouldn't envision the ABD population putting certain subsets of them under managed care, would you? I mean, isn't my understanding is that the thinking would carve out people in, say, nursing homes. Is that correct?
Yeah, when Mercer did the study, we had taken out the long-term care.
We had taken those out?
Yeah, they did it in phases for us.
Did you provide our committee with, like, numbers of what percentage of them are in nursing home? And what about, like,
what percentage of the ABD population,
yeah,
Senator?
The ones that were of the total set that might generate savings, you know, and then I guess dual eligibles. Would you envision dual eligibles being covered by managed care?
Dual eligibles were outside the analysis because with dual eligibles, any savings opportunities
and you
are, frankly,
envision that
go to the federal government because they support
waiver services. That would be carved out, and so would pharmacy.
Frankly, I mean, in the analysis, we had requested that they carve those services out. The pharmacy, as long as we get rebates on our pharmacy and we have a pharmacy tax, it's more beneficial from a cost basis, and we manage our pharmacy
very well. Once you carve
out,
of all the ABD population, once you carve out all the dual eligibles, which is for pretty much anybody over 65 on Medicare, and then once you carve out the people in the nursing homes, then who do you have left? Just only disabled, pretty much, don't you? People on disability and the blind?
Yes, and the people with the disabilities, those are the highest cost. So as far as the cost goes, they're a high-cost population.
Are you familiar with this study that was done by Joel Ferber? Of the Legal Services of Eastern Missouri, expanding Medicaid managed care to people with disabilities and seniors would be risky and unwise. Have you been exposed to that?
Senator, I yes, but I've read it several months ago.
Okay, well, I just wondered if you have taken the concerns into account of the things that this report suggested. Have you thought about them?
I mean, I've looked at it as well, and like I said, I think you know, some the analysis we looked at was, first of all, from a budget perspective, and obviously, like we testified, maybe perhaps in out years there could be some savings, but this is a pretty large population, very expensive. So, frankly, $14.5 million is not a lot of general revenue in that population. Although it's a lot when we're talking about a $700 million deficit. But I think the other thing too is, you know, at this point we are really neutral as far as from a budget perspective. So then it just becomes a policy decision. And like I said, some of the other things that we're looking at besides managed care is this new health care home model. That is a new opportunity that CMS has provided us just recently that we didn't have that opportunity in the past or have that to talk about when we were talking about this issue last year.
Okay, and then I just wanted to know, has the department had any discussions with any managed care companies that are proposing to put the ABD population on a managed care program at all?
I have not been in any part of those conversations. I frankly don't know if anyone else in the department has been or not, but I haven't been part of those conversations.
I just thought I might point out to the other members of the committee something that's really interesting that came to my attention. And it was from a Forbes magazine article from April of 2008. And there was a company that was doing business, I think it was in Texas and Ohio. But anyway, it said that this company, which is called Centene, what they did was it said Centene said it would drop coverage of the age-blind and disabled in northwestern Ohio by July, owing to heavy costs from a record flu season. I thought that was interesting. we go and we put this population on managed care, and then they drop out just because they had a heavy flu season. You know, it seems to me that we might be putting this population of Missouri citizens at pretty significant risk. And thank you for the inquiry.
Any other questions, either on the or these two individuals regarding managed care, either statewide or under item four, under the age blind, covering the age blind and disabled population under managed care? Okay. Seeing none, thank you. We're going to open this up for discussion, so don't all rush the front, those who have an interest in this, but anyone who would like that has a comment or hopefully a helpful comment on managed care and a state policy as it relates to the age blind and disabled population. Does anyone care to share their opinion on that? Sean. Please state your name for the committee.
Thank you. My name is Sean DeBria. I'm the public policy specialist for Paraquire Center for Independent Living in St. Louis. Thank you for the time. I just want to echo what Dr. Schaff said very eloquently about some of our concerns. I think managed care in terms of care coordination is some of the things I'm sure that many of you all have been hearing from a policy standpoint would be wonderful. But there are many examples of where that's fallen short. And so we're concerned about cost as well as everyone in terms of the folks that we represent. At the same time, we want to make sure that they get the services that they need. And so there are some unique things about Missouri that makes that more difficult in a managed care situation. You've heard that talked about just a moment ago. But one thing that has not been mentioned is in terms of the way we deal with provider taxes, in terms of hospitals, pharmacies, et cetera, making it a unique situation for us in terms of the way we get a significant amount of funding through provider taxes for our Medicaid services? How would that be dealt with in the managed care system? So, I mean, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered in terms of exactly how this will work for that population that we would really need to sit down and really discuss, and I hope that we proceed carefully on that score. As was also talked about in terms of the various carve-outs, you're basically left with folks that are in the home and community-based services, CDS and in-home, and we want to make sure that those people will retain those services and that those services will retain the integrity of the principles that undergird them. So we have some very significant concerns, and we hopefully that as we continue and go forward with these discussions, that we'll look very carefully at some of the claims that are being made about cost savings. If it's only as a cost savings measure, then people are going to lose their services. They're at risk of losing their services. And then, therefore, they'll end up in emergency rooms, and therefore there will be cost associated with that. So hopefully we'll be careful how we proceed forward.
Do you have any familiarity with the medical home model that the department was discussing, that they're currently researching?
A bit. I understand the Department of Mental Health is going forward with the pilot related to that, and they have some very good ideas. And so that will be something that we'd like to talk more on, because it may be more of a people-centered model rather than just a cost savings structure. And so, again, we understand very clearly that we're in a budget crisis and situation that needs to be addressed. And we, you know, in terms of Centers for Independent Living, are very concerned about that as well. We want to just make sure that people who need the services have access to those services. And we think the medical home model may do that better than a managed care model.
Okay. Any questions? Or Sean? Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming forward. Anyone else to share their thoughts on managed care, good, bad, or indifferent? Please proceed forward. Just come on forward.
And your potential cost.
Questions for Scott? None. Thank you very much for coming forward. Anyone else wishing to comment on managed care? Okay, we'll go ahead and move to the fifth item, Medicaid cost containment. I filed the bill last year. The bill was originally filed in the House. I think it was part of a raft of proposals first offered by the administration, projected to save, I think, at the time of filing, around $120 million. That bill was heard in the House committee, and then that's where it stayed. may remember some of the more controversial provisions, the ones that were ultimately dropped, where I think possibly managed care was a part of it, though I'm not certain, but definitely a part was related to psychotropic drugs and how those would be administered. And ultimately, the bill, I think, saved about $23 million or somewhere in that neighborhood. And state provided for a third-party administrator for personal care attendant services. I think that was probably the major, still the last remaining major provision, and one that it will continue to be monitored. I don't know what the administration's planning to do related to the psychotropic drugs, but it's something that I had heard from people who are in community case-based care and mental health services is that there were problems occurring in the state with, number one, the over-prescribing of psychotropic drugs, and also with when psychotropic drugs being prescribed for young people, teens, and there's a combination of there are other therapies and other types of care which would be very beneficial to that person, which would be separate from prescribing those drugs, and certainly we don't need to be giving over-prescribing drugs. So I don't know what the thoughts are. There's some savings there, but their consensus was not reached on that issue. And I guess, does any member of the committee have familiarity with that discussion and want to talk further about it? Senator Schaaf?
Yes, I also heard the same concerns that you had, and so I quizzed down the department, and there are cases where the department becomes aware of providers that are sort of doing outrageous things, prescribing strong psychotropics or in inappropriate doses to young kids. Those are the kinds of things that you had heard about, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I asked, when you see a prescriber, doing these things, do you notify the State Board of Healing Arts? That here's somebody that's just totally, doing the wrong thing. What it sounds to me that the problem there isn't that we need to just have generics only and not name brand drugs, which is what pretty much the idea of the whole thing is, or to have a limited
formula. It's kind of like a step therapy.
What's needed, right? What's needed is to have some, training to bring some of these doctors, make them aware that what they're doing isn't the standard of care somehow. And that's not happening. The other thing is that, I can tell you from personal experience that when somebody's been stabilized on a given drug, you don't want to be messing with that. You want to leave them there. If you don't, then what you might end up with is a person who is going to stress our system further by requiring hospitalization, end up in jail, kind of going off the deep end. And so, there might be unintended consequences. So whatever we do, we need to tread very carefully, and I would hate to have us come out as a committee and say that we ought to get behind this effort. What we ought to do is maybe study it.
I guess is there anyone from the Department of Mental Health or from the governor's office that would like to comment on maybe any progress that's been made on related to psychotropic drugs or other cost containment measures for Medicaid? Please, if you'll state your name and your job title, appreciate it.
Brent McGinney, Department of Mental Health, Director of Administration. I'm not the expert in this area, but I know that, and Social Services might want to comment too, but I believe in the prescription, the pharmaceutical program, there have been, I believe in October, November, there might have been some edits or some actions taken to, like Dr. Schaff said, maybe more clearly identify out of the norm practices and be able to catch some of those and flag those. But I'll have to get back to the committee on some of the details of that.
Do we have any questions? Okay. And thank you. And I see our chairman is back.
Thank you, Senator. So that was number five, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Okay, number six on the recommendations from last year is department division consolidation and reform. We wanted to look at removing or consolidating duplicate roles and responsibility in our MoHealthNet and three departments, looking for a single point of entry into MoHealthNet. I think it's over three different divisions, considering consolidating social services, mental health, and Department of Health and Senior Services. That would take constitutional change. Do we have anyone from the departments that would like to comment on savings that could be realized in the MoHealthNet by having one system point of entry rather than three ways to get into the program in three separate divisions? That just seems like it has to make sense. You have three ways to guard the three ways to allow people in your business. You need to have salespeople at every three to sell them on a product, but if you had one person coming in, one way to get in, you could have one person right there. There's got to be cost savings. God, last year you guys were so much more into this. Are we back in the protect the status quo mode here, or are we actually looking for ideas and savings? Okay. Bueller? Bueller. Hey, Senator,
yes.
Chime on in here.
Well, actually, since I'm very new to this committee and to the Senate, I would like to inquire of you. And one of my questions has to do with, I had a conversation in the last week with someone familiar with this consolidation. And from my understanding, they were saying that two departments are programmatic and the other is fiscal. And by consolidating them, it's not really a savings because they each do something different. So from your vantage point, I would like to know, knowing that two are programmatic, strictly programs, and the other is a fiscal entity, how it would give us savings as a state.
I think that every time that someone comes into the system, there has to be what an assessment done and various different services, and I think that having three different departments, and this is just the idea from last year, again, having three different departments, three different people doing assessments, three different people doing monitoring, three different people doing paperwork, getting them in some way, various different agencies, there's got to be cracks, way people are falling through and duplication of services. I don't think that the fiscal savings would be that huge by the consolidating the departments like we saw with Ed and higher ed. It was like $1 million of savings. But I think it was from the taxpayer and person accessing the service. Also, was there as a fiscal savings, but also there is like, this is where I go, this is what I have to do, and this is how I get in versus, I mean, if you had to explain to the average person, well, you could qualify here, 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 or here, and under this program, kind of like we did with the autism office. One entry, the call, here's your answer your questions. So it was more of a little bit of a both of that, and that's where the idea came from, but realizing that you'd have to have the vote of the people and change the Constitution.
Do you foresee any issues with HIPAA?
As far as?
As consolidate, if you're sharing information or you're putting all of these departments in one, I guess there wouldn't be an issue, but it just seems as though if we are consolidating, we may not have the opportunity fully help a consumer a patient, a person, as adequately as we can. If there are individuals who are no longer part of that department who are most fit to deal with the needs of that consumer.
Well, I think what you would do is you consolidate them under one banner of Department of Health and whatever you want to call it. And then you could have three silos in there where they provide their individual services, but you basically would just put them under one agency, and you could have three separate divisions inside of there. But having three separate agencies, there's got to be some type of a fiscal impact. Just common sense would think that, and then also just the ease of access for the taxpayer.
So how does that change, though, if you still have the same number of people that you're helping, and you still have the same needs that need to be addressed? The number of people that we need to help in this state is not going to be reduced. So you're just saying, purely from the employment standpoint, the individuals who are working in that department. Because looking at the amount of money that we're spending in Medicaid and in health care, everything says that that's going to increase anyway. So if there is a savings, it seems as though there would only be a short-term savings and not a long-term savings.
Well, if there's a savings, why wouldn't you at least continue with these types of a process and figure out if there isn't a savings, just because it might not be a huge long-term savings. There's a short-term savings. We could use that money to reduce the wait list.
And are there other states that you've looked at that have actually done this kind of consolidation?
Well, Missouri did it back, under Ashcroft or something. They've combined agencies and restructured government. And I mean, every state has done it in some shape. Some have done it, and some have done it the opposite. They've expanded different ways. I mean, they've...
Do we know the success rate of that? I just
14.586%.
Thank you, Chief.
And again, what these are, this process is not to sit here and defend everything or to promote these or to say this is great. It's just to have this conversation, to get buy-in, to answer these questions of, are these things even things that we should look at as a Senate as a whole? Last year we had one day, we went through these, we had 8 recommendations, we went out, presented it to the whole Senate, and some of those were done. Some of them, we realized these are long-term goals, and some of them, after we delved into the layers of the onion, figured out, nah, it's not worth it. So again, I encourage you, if this is something that you really want to look at, by all means, you want to bring back to the reboot or the other senators on this is the reasons this is the best thing or the worst thing, we're gladly looking for input, considering the members of the audience have been pretty much quiet the entire day. Okay, moving right along. Charge fees for licensing of daycare facilities, EMT, paramedics, and others. There were 4,200 daycare facilities times a fee would have to generate some type of a revenue for the state. Legislative action would be required. The estimated savings was unknown. We even had commentary from the audience last year when people decided to participate that they would have places that weren't even charging a fee, and we were processing a license. And we were actually doing state work, and there wasn't even a fee for the state doing work on, I don't even know if it was daycares or whatever it was. So can anyone from the department discuss this? Do we know where this is at? Yes, come on down.
Hello, I'm Teresa Generous. I'm the Director of Regulation and Licensure in the Department of Health, in which child care and also EMS is housed. At this time, we don't currently charge a fee, and basically the status is the same as the comments that were made last year. We do provide licensing, and we would certainly follow the will of the General Assembly and charge a fee if there was legislation passed that allowed us to do that.
So you're licensing facilities on just the good... just general benevolence of your department?
I don't know about general benevolence, but yes, Senator. I mean, we go out, we do provide services, and we evaluate. We go out and...
What would you estimate your cost is to provide those services?
I can probably get that for you.
That would be good to at least see what the expenditure in your department is for those types of things on behalf of those facilities, and break that down.
I can provide that to you.
Any questions or anything? And to the EMTs, I remember we talked about that last time. We license them, and they have an exam and stuff, but they don't pay for that?
They don't. There has been in the past an attempt to pass some regulations that would charge, and that they have not gone through.
Okay. Do we know what the break-even point is for those? Just
I can provide that financial. I'll get that financial information for you.
Maybe not looking to make money off of private entities, but if they're providing a service, maybe it's a break-even point for the for services being provided would be something we could consider. Any comments or questions on last year's recommendation? Child support enforcement. I know that there was some legislation that was filed last year on this. I believe it was Senator from Cape. He had a lot of information on the amount of money being spent on this and the bang for your buck, I guess. Anyone here from the division? Come on up. What was talked about last time was charging a fee for the enforcement of child support, considering the cost if we were to privatize child support enforcement. Have we made any progress on that, or can you give us an update?
I'm Allison Campbell. I'm the director of the Family Support Division, which manages the child support program. I will start with fees, if that's okay.
Sure.
We had presented a legislative proposal last year to charge fees for child support services. We do intend to present a proposal again this year for those charges.
So currently now you're not charging anything to enforce the collection of child support, or are you, or explain that?
We don't have any fees to applicants of our child support services. There are payment processing fees of $10 that are charged to people whose payments are managed through our Family Support Payment Center. And
you guys collect the money and then disperse it out, or is it like
yes.
the garnishment of a check, and then it comes in, and then you disperse it out to the rightful. Or
that's
the,
correct.
And is that a monthly fee or a?
It's an annual fee.
$10 annual fee.
And just to clarify, for the child support program, our Family Support Payment Center receipts and disperses all child support payments in Missouri. Whether or not the recipient of that payment is actually on our case roll. So we call those non-4D cases, which means the people that are the payee on those cases have not asked for our services. But it's statutorily required that those payments go through the payment center, just like cases that we manage. And a $10 annual fee is charged on those cases.
For people. To the person paying child support or receiving?
It's taken out of the collection. So ultimately, it's the payee that has that $10 annual fee.
We talked about didn't we privatize a portion of this? We had privatized in the past.
We have privatized several functions within the program. And we have, for example, I'll just give you a few. Our Family Support Payment Center is contracted because they have the expertise and the technologies to do that much more efficiently than we could. We have a contract for genetic testing when paternity needs to be established for a child. We have a call center contract that manages calls coming in from our clients, our customers. They manage about 850 to a million calls a year for us. And so they can certainly do that more efficiently than we can. Recently, we continued to look at privatization over the summer and into the fall. Another area that we recently awarded a contract for is for what we call new hire information, where employers they provide information to us about new hires. And that allows us to learn about where people are employed so that we can be more effective in collecting child support. We contracted for a new service on our new hire, just awarded that about a month ago. We're anticipating to see pretty significant increases in our collections as a result of that.
What is the total general revenue that we spend on child support enforcement?
I don't know off the top of my head. I can get that for you.
You can give me the total of what we spend in GR versus the number of clients that we that you provide a service, whether or not they're, so we can kind of see what we're, what do we spend as a state per individual that we're collecting. It'd be interesting to look at. And do you get any federal other match money?
We do.
Yeah.
We earn incentives. Excuse me. We earn incentives on our program on five federal performance measures that we are assessed on. And we also, there's a match rate, 34% approximately.
So will we spend 34 cents on a dollar? The feds match us with 66 cents?
Yes.
You could break that down for me and get it to the entire committee, please.
We do have a, we serve about 340,000 people in Missouri.
Okay. So do you remember our, when it says charge a fee here, what our thought process was last year? I don't remember. Since you're charging the fee for the collect, what was the conversation we had last year on charging a fee?
In the reboot hearing, I think it was whether or not we should charge a fee, you know, based upon the number of recipients in the program, kind of where you were just going, Senator.
Okay.
And, you know, we did have a bill out there last year that did not pass. I think it was just whether or not we should.
What was the fiscal note on that bill? Do you remember?
I've got some numbers here for you. The cost to implement the fees, we had some one-time mailing cost of about $34,000. We had some systems changes to make in our automated system to process the fees of about $93,000. We did not ask for any new FTE to do it. And we think that as far as what we might see as a result, as far as income, is on the $10 fee to include the cases that we're managing, it would result in about $686,000. $233,000 of that would be state.
So to charge the same fee that you're charging on the other people for the would net GR about $280,000.
Right. And then we had some other fees, and if you'd like, I can get that information to you along with the cost.
Yeah, if
and
you
the,
would. I think sure. I know I'm a little fuzzy on that.
Sure.
So. I know Senator Dempsey has to leave, and he wanted to address a couple of things that might not, I don't think it's on this issue, but Senator, if you want to go ahead.
Yeah, got to head out at 12:30, but just for the committee's consideration, we haven't adopted the report yet. The Joint Committee on Legislative Research hasn't, but I wanted, what you have before you is a couple pages from the Sunset Review of the Missouri RX program. And just wanted to point the committee to, not the entire report, but page 8, where it details the growth of the Missouri RX program. And then in the report talks about a report that the National Conference of State Legislatures put together detailing this, I guess, how states looked at the donut hole, and Missouri was a part of that, and just showed that there was there were a variety of approaches that states adopted. And I know with the federal health care law that they have their own solution to the to coverage in this area. I mean, as you're all aware, it's a 100% GR funded program that was begun in the last 10 years. And then the only other information that's provided in the handout before you is just showing the state expenditures for the RX program, with the first year of $2.4 million to $23.2 million last year. Just really a little food for thought as we look at all the decisions that have to be made this year. Just something that caught my eye as I read the report the other day, and thought it might spur some discussion. So really don't have a direction that I necessarily want to head with it today.
Anybody else want to comment on that subject matter? Do you have any questions of any of the departments or anybody while they're here?
I know, well, had the, I guess this falls under social services, had the governor say that he wanted a reauthorization of the program? Is make that announcement? He did. Okay. All right. Okay. 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 So at the time we adopted this, there was no prescription drug benefit provided by the federal government through Medicare. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. I'm just throwing it out there.
Very good.
As we consider a whole
spirit
of possibility.
Yeah. Throw ideas, see if they stick
right
to the wall.
Right. So, all right. Thank you.
Awesome.
That was the only.
All right. Oh, this was the one that really stuck in my craw. Includes step parents' income when determining eligibility for MoHealthNet and other benefits. Could be done internally. Has it been done, and if not, why? There's got to be someone here from the department. We're on step parent income when determining eligibility for MoHealthNet and other benefits.
Allison Campbell, Family Support. The question, as I recall last year, was whether or not a step-parent's income could be included when determining eligibility for MoHealthNet. And there is a federal federal law that excludes step-parent income from our calculation. Step-parents don't have a legal obligation to their children unless there is a state law that generally applies to that responsibility.
So if we have a state law that says we can do it, we can do it? Is that what you said?
And I am not an attorney, so I know that what the federal site says is a step-parent's income is prohibited from being included in the calculation for Medicaid eligibility determination purposes unless a state law of general applicability applies or something to that effect. The site, if you'd like to have that site, is 42 CFR.
We'll just take your word for it.
Okay. All right.
You're not an attorney, so that means I already trust you. So basically, this could be done by passing a state law that says for the taxpayers to provide MoHealthNet benefits for a family member. And let's say they have a just a gross income of $750,000, but maybe one person earns that, the other is a stay-at-home parent who has the stepkids, that we could then, in that household, calculate that for eligibility.
I think someone other than me would need to do legal research on that, Senator.
Can we have research? They're already on it. Go right ahead.
Does this 42 CFR regulation that you referred to, does it apply to other things other than MoHealthNet, like, for example, child care, TANF benefits, housing?
Senator Schaaf, I'm not certain. I would have to look at the site again. I know specifically it talked about MoHealthNet. The other thing, excuse me, the other thing that just occurs to me, too, is there is another site under the Affordable Care Act, I believe, that prohibits us from being more restrictive in our eligibility requirements than we are today. And I don't have that site with me, but that might impact.
That's only on the stimulus dollars through the end of this year. I think after this fiscal year, those changes could be made without.
That's, Mr. Chairman, that's a really important question to have answered, and I've asked that before and never have gotten an adequate answer to that. Because if I've been told that if we increase the requirements, or, you know, I guess, how did you say it, decrease the eligibility?
You can't make the
requirements. We have to pay back all of that money in retroactively. Go back. Do either of you know?
The senator's right. There's a moratorium and there's a maintenance of effort on eligibility under ARRA federal law, as well as Affordable Care Act federal law. So it's in both laws, and so we'll stop receiving the ARRA dollars in June. But the Affordable Care Act, as long as it's still federal law, would be applicable and would have those same maintenance of effort requirements. And I believe those go through 2013 generally for adults. We have put together some citations on and language. We'd be happy to share that with the committee from both the ARRA and from the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, so you said that the one ends in June, and that is for what, kids?
Well, no, there's two different laws in federal laws. One is ARRA, and as long as we receive the enhanced FMAP under ARRA, the MOE, the maintenance of effort on eligibility, is in place, and we'll stop receiving that unless there's some kind of extension in June of 2011 this year. But the Affordable Care Act that was passed last February, that also has a Medicaid eligibility maintenance of effort provision in it. And generally, that provision requires us to maintain eligibility for our adults and under 65 through 2013, I believe, or 14. And I can, like I said, I can get the information. And then actually children, it's longer. I believe it's 2017.
Wait, so you're saying that adults, we can't do it until 2013, and for kids, we couldn't do it for 2017.
I believe it's 2000. I'll get you the exact date in the law.
Do you believe that by counting step-parents' income and that would be?
I don't know. We would frankly we would seek some guidance from our attorneys to look at that provision of the Affordable Care Act and what we, you know, would be recommending, perhaps, you know, to count step-parent income and see whether or not that would count or not. And I believe there's also been some guidance from CMS on this as well that we could look at.
Okay. Is your department the one that administers housing? For people, you know, housing for like single moms?
No. We have some programs around, and frankly, it's more around some one-time stimulus dollars to help individuals who are low income and might need some rent assistance, et cetera. But most of the HUD funding, the federal HUD funding, is actually in Department of Economic Development under MHDC.
So who is it that, which department looks at, say, a single mom gets on housing, there's a requirement that the household income be computed. Who is it that administers that and makes sure that the household income does fall within the guidelines?
I believe that would be Department of Economic Development.
Well, now there's a something that could be consolidated, Mr. Chairman. You know? Okay, well, thank you so much.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, the next two on the list, I'm just going to skip. Anybody has any questions, you can... We can deal with those later. Let's head into the emails. This is what we did last time. It seemed to work. Base guy, what I did is I just took a general consensus and feel from the committee on if this is something that we should put in the... But we had a yes pile, maybe pile, a no pile, and a hell no pile. So we have four piles. You just guys kind of give me a sense of where we're going to put these. Some of these would be very duplicative. There'll be some that apparently were written where people didn't take their medication. And we'll probably just skip a few of those. So we're basically, this is the general topics. And starting on page number one. And if you tend to notice, every single one of these was sent by a guy named Patrick Baker. Isn't that weird? All right, this one is from Kansas City. Everyone just take a brief moment to peruse those. Okay, this talks about cutting welfare. There's really no suggestions there. I say we just skip it. The next one from Perryville, Missouri, on page 2. Any person that is on state aid should be denied any aid if that person has an active warrant or is in custody. This would help law enforcement clear up a lot of warrants, plus save money by not giving it to non-law-abiding citizens. So basically, if you're receiving state aid and you have a warrant out for you, that law enforcement should talk to social services and hand-deliver the check and arrest them? Is that what I'm reading? Put that one in the questionable pile. I created the fifth pile. All right, the next one. This is from Anonymous, page 3. While working for state and city governments. Do you guys have copies of these? All right. If it's interesting, I'll start to read from it. If not, you're going to have to just look at my forehead. Reassessment on SSI or disability. How often are these assessments made to see if someone should continue to get... Hey, it's on the screen. How often are we assessing someone that's receiving benefits?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I can speak to this a little
bit. Awesome.
As a physician, you know, I see people come to see me that are on disability, and from time to time, when I see them, I think to myself, why is this person on disability? And they tell me about, you know, what they do, mowing the lawn, you know, doing things. And I wonder, you know, whether or not they should be reevaluated from time to time. I think that maybe we need to look at this. On the flip side, I see people who are very clearly disabled, and when they apply for disability, they don't apply to the state first. They apply to the federal government first, and they're almost always denied, even though it should be obvious to the average person that they qualify. So that should also be looked at. And
is this mostly a federal issue?
It can be.
They're applying for SSI.
It can be. But then what we do is we as a state then just kind of automatically cover people who have applied while they wait for their appeal.
And then what if the appeal is still denied, then what happens?
We'd have to ask the department for the exact way that this goes down. But it's perverse. The whole thing needs to be reviewed.
Anyone from the department want to comment? We're providing benefits for those while their application is on appeal? And then what happens if their appeal is denied? If you could get the information to the committee, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure, go right ahead.
The thing is that if the federal government's process worked, then we should immediately not cover people who are denied, you know? I mean, that's what really needs to happen. Maybe we need to somehow or another work with the federal government to do a better job.
Can you also find out, and not to interrupt, you had a great idea there, find out how many people we're providing benefits to, and then for what is the length until they're approved, and what the dollar amount that could be calculated on that we're spending until they're approved? As if they were efficient. Yes. How often are they reassessed on the state level? I think that was what the email was actually getting at. Thank you. All right. Many members have woken up besides Senator Schaaf. I love it. All right. Next one from Patrick Baker. Page 4. From Cape Girardeau. Must have moved. This is basically Medicaid patients traveling to various ERs. I think this is probably like a technological medical record type of a... Is there any savings there to the department where we're doing... If someone's getting an MRI last month and then next month they go in for an MRI, is it in the system? Or is there another MRI ordered?
Senator, in the past year, we've actually implemented a contract where we look at imaging benefits. So we look at, through cyber access, there are online tool, we know how many particular maybe codes or services an individual has received, or a CT scan or some type of imaging benefit, and we're able to see when was the last one performed, should we perform that based on what they're seeing with that patient, et cetera. So we, if you will, have a kind of a gatekeeper to make sure that we're better managing those that type of benefit.
And is that only on imaging, you said?
It's on imaging, and right now it's on imaging.
Can that be expanded to other things, or is this just brand new and you're working out the kinks and then you're...
Frankly, we can get more information on what other services it might make sense fiscally to expand that to. I'd probably have to have Dr. McCaslin or someone else from MoHealthNet to speak to that, but we'd be happy to provide some information to the committee and what duration we'd want to see, you know, as far as what we're doing right now before we...
Senator Schaaf has some questions.
Mr. Chairman, this gentleman, Richard, who sent this, is espousing a lot of concerns that I have and have been banging my head against the wall for 8 years. And I've found out that we as a state are so limited in so many ways getting at the problems that he talks about. Like, for example, he talks about people who come in who have obviously, you know, a cell phone. They drive in a Suburban. They're wearing excellent clothes. They have tattoos all over their arms. They're, you know, obviously can afford alcohol, and yet we, the people, are providing their medical care for them. And it's an age-old problem of expecting people who receive money from the state to be responsible. And so I started off years ago by asking, you know, do we know how many of our Medicaid patients smoke? And I was told that we're not allowed to ask. But then we passed a MoHealthNet reform bill, and we said that everybody would have to complete an initial assessment. We put in several million dollars into the budget. And then part of that assessment should be, you know, do you smoke? I mean, that's the first thing you ask your doctor. Still haven't got the results from that. Well, I mean, if you can afford cigarettes, then, you know, that's $100 a month probably. You know, then basically what's happened is we, the citizens, are paying for their cigarettes instead of their health care.
Can we charge we can get a smoking rate and a non-smoking rate when you go buy a health policy. Can we, as in MoHealthNet, have a smoking rate and a non-smoking rate?
I don't know. I don't believe we can.
Not under federal law. And, you know,
a lot of changes in the federal law. Are we sure?
Oh, we can, you know.
We can revisit that.
And you can expand this question about smoking to everything else. You know, one of the things that I thought of was just simply, you know, how they have on the riverboat, they have the do not gamble list, mm-hmm. and you can put yourself on it. Well, maybe what we ought to do is put every single Medicaid recipient on the do not gamble list. I mean, because after all, if they can gamble, I mean, they ought to be spending their money on their own health care. And
hi. Oh, I can't wait.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This letter brings up so many things to me that one is there something in law that we could not triage? Basically, or that's what I would call it. And a guy comes in for the third time this month with a backache, and we not say this is not an emergency, here's your appointment with Dr. So-and-so next Tuesday. Is that possible to do?
I don't know. We do have some ER diversion projects right now, and we do have like some services where they have to be prior authorized, and you would go back and you would look at what services that individual has received.
Well, let me give you an example. I only know what's in front of me usually, and this is something I've talked about in my hometown. Guy comes into emergency ward with a toothache. He's going to get a bottle of oxycodone. That's what he's going to get. They're not going to pull his tooth. 2 weeks later, he's going to be back with the same bad tooth. They're going to charge another $450. They're going to charge each time to Medicaid. They're going to give him another bottle. By the time we've done it the third time, we've got him hooked on oxycodone, and he's still got a bad tooth in his mouth, and $90 most dentists would have pulled the damn tooth. Why can't we do that?
I will certainly take that question back, that issue, and we'll look at it. I frankly am just not a Medicaid expert.
I'm not sure it's totally your fault. I think the hospitals like getting the $450, frankly. But there needs to be something done there where there are dentists out there that would see that patient. I guarantee you. I've talked to them. And why we can't get him from the emergency ward to that dentist, I don't get. I mean, to me, it saves us a lot of money. That's one little tiny thing, but there's so many other things that would follow suit.
Managed care might help with that.
Well, possibility, Senator. I just, that's something that just drives me a little nuts.
Right.
I'm off my soapbox.
That's all right. It's livened it up here. I'm liking it. You, someone want to comment? Sure.
But if I could come up with dentists, which I have in Springfield, Missouri, that would see that patient, you know? And if we've got an FQHC that is getting federal money, I think we ought to be able to lean on them a little bit to see that patient. There ought to be a chair there to see that patient. I mean, there's got to be some way of getting that person out of that $450 emergency ward visit that didn't take care of the problem to begin with. Well, we need to give them some kind of an ability to say, you know what, your toothache's not a problem here. You're in the wrong spot. Here's your appointment.
Maybe they're just anti-dentites.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
To comment on the senator's comments, you know, sometimes those people that go to the emergency room and get that oxycodone turn around and sell those pills on the market for maybe $10, $15, $20 a piece. And there are people who go to pain management clinics, and they make a really good living, $40,000 to $70,000 a year, just going once a month and getting their pain medicines. And they're very difficult to stop that, and we're footing the bill. Basically, they're selling their month-long prescription of, you know, every four-hour pain pills, which you multiply times a month. I mean, you know, that's a lot of money. The other thing is, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned managed care, how that might save, and that's an excellent point. But thinking through that a little bit more deeply, you know, if managed care, which is at risk for, you know, the every four-day visit to the emergency room, can have the latitude to spend the money to send him to the dentist and put a stop to that, then there's no reason why the state of Missouri can't also put some money in a fund and have a decision maker within the department, which would be the equivalent of the decision maker within the managed care company, make that same decision to authorize the spending out of a given pot of money. And we have a thing, don't we? It's called the Bureau of Special Healthcare Needs for Kids, and I think something like that. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't structure a decision maker within the department who's looking out for the assets of the state to make that decision, just like the head guy of the managed care company is looking out for his own personal assets. You know, we should be able to do this. I mean, there's no reason the managed care company. The other thing is, you know, maybe people need to be reevaluated. Just like we had talked about under the disability, maybe we need to reevaluate them a little more often when they're on the Medicaid program.
How often is someone reevaluated on Medicaid? Medicare? Either one. How's that?
As far as eligibility, eligibility is redetermined annually. So we actually do not. Now, I don't know to what extent we, frankly, I mean, we'll have to get more information on the SSI.
They have to provide tax returns. They have to.
Allison can answer a little bit more about what that determination looks like, but we actually look at that individual's information annually.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
So that brings up another point. You know how you talked about stepchildren or step-parents and counting their income in. If when you do household income, do you take into account the income of all adults living in the home that are not step-parents? Like, for example, the live-in boyfriend. And the follow-up question would be, if you don't, why not? And is there a federal law that would prevent you from doing that, just like the step-parent question?
We do not count another adult's income that's in the household when we're determining eligibility. We don't because they don't have a legal financial responsibility for that child. The federal regulations, most are written to say a parent or an adoptive parent, and so we do not consider a live-in boyfriend or another adult in the home when we're determining eligibility.
Well, I just want to point out, which is probably immediately obvious, but if I were a single mom on welfare, and I knew that if I were to get married to a gentleman and live in the state of marriage, that I would lose my benefit, then I would choose to have that person move in and live outside the state of marriage. And so what we have here is an incentive for people not to marry. And I think it's been proven over and over again that people who are living in a married situation as opposed to otherwise, they live longer, they're more mentally healthy, they have less health problems, the kids are better off. I mean, there's so many benefits. You know, maybe we really seriously need to look at that. And the question is this a federal law that prohibits us, or is it a state law?
Federal is written that you can only consider the income of the parent or the, I think it's some of the sites say adoptive parent. It's written that way.
In the federal law, there are no exceptions, even if we have a law of general applicability, which what you talked about earlier.
Again, Senator, I'm not sure on that.
Okay, that's really critically important, so we need to answer to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No problem. All right, moving on. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, please go right ahead.
Make a statement. Okay. We're talking about saving taxpayer dollars, and I just hope when we're having these conversations, and they're going to be pretty deep and strenuous conversations at times, that we do not get into a position where we are legislating morality, because that could actually cost us more to go into people's bedrooms and their homes.
I think what we're doing is just trying to identify the cost savings today, and then all those conversations will be
done later. So,
thank you.
All right. Now the next one is from Patrick Baker on page 5. This is benefit eligibility using the U.S. poverty level figures, not multipliers of the poverty level figures. Assuming that due to the ARRA money and health care that we're locked into these and making any kind of a change up or down until 2013. Is that the same answer? Do you guys want to just sit up here?
We use the percentage of poverty multipliers when we are calculating eligibility. And I'm not sure that I entirely understand what this gentleman is asking for.
So I think he's saying if poverty level is this percent, and we use, if you're 150%, so then if your income's $10,000, that's poverty level. But if you're 12.5, you could still qualify because we're higher than the federal poverty level. That's what the way I read it.
I would need a little more time to look into that and see.
But the basic question is, we couldn't change eligibility until after 2013 due to the Affordable Correct thing.
There are eligibility changes saying you can't be more restrictive that are in the Affordable Care Act. And again, we think until 2013 for part of the population and potentially to 2017, but we're going to follow up on that for you.
Yeah, if you could find out what populations when.
Yes.
Not that we are going to change eligibility, but we'd like to know all of our options. Okay, number page 6. This deals with First Steps program and the copay. They would like to pay more into the program. Programs in DESE, we'll send that one over to DESE. 7. Alternative to abortions. This is basically just an appropriations decision, not really a transforming state government. Go on to number 8. Section 8, which is a federal program. Go on to page 9. This again gets into the eligibility for disability. Go on to page 10. Sure.
On the one on page 9, basically I thought that this was about, you know, if a guy has to submit drug testing in his job, then it ought to be right that somebody receiving welfare benefits or Medicaid ought to submit to drug testing to get those. And, you know, I think that's a good idea myself. And we actually passed that out of the House last year. I don't know what it did over here in the Senate, but I think that there's something there that would help to, you know, put an incentive into people not to waste their money on drugs.
Oh, I see that line in the middle, one sentence there. Yeah, that's something that both houses have recommended. Do we have any idea how much money that would save? Do we have any idea how many people on welfare are using drugs? If it's just a no, you can just stand back there. And
I can tell you that, in general, I believe the statistics show about 8% of the American total population has used drugs within the last 30 days. Don't have any reason to believe that the population would be any different. And as far as savings, we don't have that. However, we have been asked for that, so we can provide that to you as well.
If you could provide it, that would be great. Page 10. This gets into the rehabilitation centers. We just spent $20 million building institutional facilities for people that are for these things to sit empty in probably 10 years. I believe that that ship has sailed. Unless someone here wants to correct me. That funding went through MHDC, is that correct? Is there anyone from MHDC here? The way I understand it now is they've classified that as Section 8 housing, and that's how they're trying to get the funding in there for people with developmental disabilities in Belle Fountain. We're talking about Belle Fountain. No one's going to refute that? No, no, I think that's how they structured this. So now we're using MHDC money to build buildings on institutional facilities for people who are now considered Section 8 eligible. And they're going to be...
Inquire of you.
Go right ahead.
Is MHDC not quasi-governmental and they produce their own funds?
Is there anyone from MHDC here wants to discuss on how they are created, operated, funded?
Because in recent years, I know there, and I say recent as in 10 years, there have been efforts to use the dollars that MHDC has, but it has never happened. And even though they are attached to state government, it's in a quasi way.
We will get the answers to that. But I believe that that is how they are funding that. And I don't believe there's anything the legislature can do. Those contracts were already bid. Construction is starting. Is there any way to stop that from happening? Anyone? Okay. Well, there's $20 million. Going to number 11. Connect all welfare offices to one state in the one database. Number of people drawing funds in multiple counties. Yo.
I'd like to really discuss this one because this one touches on the problem of identifying if you are who you say you are. And, you know, I imagine that the department is already connected to one big database. But the problem is that if we don't know that these people are who they say they are. Like, for example, you go to one county and you give a name. You go to another county and you give a different name. Well, we shouldn't be providing services to those people twice. And another example is the mother who takes her kids into the welfare office. Only the problem is that they are all her kids, and so she gets benefits based upon an inflated number of children, or she gets benefits for a child who doesn't deserve the benefits because they really should be covered by someone who wouldn't qualify. And so one thing that we need to look at is something like retina scanning technology, where if you're going to apply for benefits, just in order to know that you are who you say you are, is a very simple little device that the person just looks in, scans their retina, and then you know that they are who they say they are. It's not invasive. And it's just a biometric identification thing. So that would solve both problems. You could do the retina scan on the children, and when somebody came in to defraud the system, you'd know immediately whose child that was. And if somebody was going to multiple different locations and getting some benefits, that they would immediately be identified. So we ought to look at some biometric thing like retina scanning.
Any questions on anything else? Anyone else? You ready to move on to the next one? Not sure. I'd cut off all welfare to those who have never worked for it except people with mental problems. All politicians in Missouri. I suppose that's us. And give incentives to companies to bring back work back to Missouri only if this increases tax revenues. I'm not sure I know where this guy's going. Moving on. Requires managed Medicaid plans to reimburse at minimum 85% of premium received to medical expenses already in place in other states. Illinois, do you know anything about that? Did you get back to us on that?
Sure.
Okay. Make sure those receiving assistance from social services are deserving and working towards being able to support themselves once they become working. Have a small amount of amount be diverted from their paychecks back to the system, even if it's only $5 or $10. I'd say that's probably illegal, isn't it? I don't think you can do that, can you? Any thoughts? Okay. The next one, do away with 12-hour meals. People can plan for one day. He left us all the duds, didn't he? any comments on this one, Doc? I think we'll pass on it, too. There's several here. How about if you see one you want to talk about, Senator, you speak up.
You know, Mr. Chairman, on the one on page 15, I think what they're getting at is state workers, when they travel, if you're going to be gone for only 12 hours, I think you're expected to take a sack lunch or something or provide for your own meal, whereas if you're going to be gone for 24 hours, then...
I actually do get that one. If somebody drove up here from, say, my area and it took less than 12 hours to get here, they would have to buy their own lunch, I assume.
Yeah, and then it says, you know, don't allow for meals and stop agency-provided food, I guess, you know, but... You know, I don't know what the total amount of it is, but as I recall, last year, the current budget chair in the House went and deducted a whole bunch of money from every department and to equalize that. Remember, Representative Sylvie did that? And so I imagine, you know, I don't know about the 24-hour rule, but... You know, maybe it's worthy of consideration. I don't know how much money it would save us. I don't think it would unnecessarily burden state workers to cover that. But
we can certainly look at it. How'd two little freshmen get left in here, Rob?
No.
We've become the committee.
This is just a repeat of the previous one.
Yeah. And we are we looking into that?
Well, we had the bill.
Yeah,
to,
that's on the agenda.
Or drug testing, and but see, it's like once again, it's something that this person is asking us to extrapolate to other areas.
Okay. Well, we've got some time, and since I seem to have the floor, something I know has been brought up here a few times. And I know the federal laws are the problem in most cases, but. To me, if you turn me loose at the meat counter at the grocery store and say, get whatever you want, we're not going to be eating Hamburger Helper tonight because if I'm not paying. even if it's $3, as I recall, is that the most feds will let us on a copay, is what I'm getting at. Should we, could we have at least some copay, even if it's 50 cents, when somebody goes to see a doctor? Is that, I mean, I just think if no skin is in the game, nobody's ever going to worry about what it costs or how many times they go. I realize that. If you could get that to us, I would appreciate that, because it always comes up, and it always comes up in my mind, too, and it does make some sense. If, you know, if everything's just free, obviously we're going to use it as much as we want. And okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Just to tag on that, one of the things that happens is people who are on Medicaid, they show up at the doctor's office or pharmacy, wherever, and they don't have the copay. And by law, you know, the provider still has to go ahead and see him. So they all know this, and so they just never have the copay. And so that just reduces the payment rate for everyone. And, you know, what we need to do is ask the federal government to say, if the copay is to be effective, make it mandatory or get rid of it. If it's, you know, why have it on the books? Either have it and mandate it or get rid of it.
Okay. Why is this next one with us? What? Oh, the second part. Okay. Well, got any questions on this one, Doc? Okay.
I mean, I totally understand the sentiment of
Brian. Yeah, I'm not saying I just soon work on something we might be able to accomplish.
Do something about. I agree. Let's go on.
I swear to God, Roop knew exactly when to leave. He knew exactly what he was doing.
It seems to me that, you know, Missouri has already said that illegal aliens won't get state benefits.
Hey, have we not?
That's on the books, isn't it? Now, the question is there adequate enforcement? And I have had people who work in social agencies come up to me and tell me that the agency doesn't adequately enforce that rule. And that, for example, a woman who comes in and says that she doesn't speak English will automatically be given benefits just because they don't ask, you know, are you an American citizen? Do you have proof of legal presence and so on. We might get the department to tell us whether they think that the enforcement of that is adequate or how they could beef it up.
Do you have any facts, figures, survey, anything that kind of says how you've accomplished this or how you've enforced it or what you've done?
I actually brought some of our information on that with me. And I would say, Senator Schaaf, that our policy would be that we are required to ask if a person is a U.S. citizen. And if we have reason to believe that they're not, then we're going to ask for proof of citizenship. And in order to qualify under our policy, in order to qualify for benefits, you have to prove that you are both a legal immigrant, an eligible and qualified immigrant. So just looking at some statistics recently, I see that, for example, MoHealth Net for Children, I'll use that as one of our program lines. We have about 5,600 kids who are legal immigrants receiving benefits. We
We had immigrant children who were rejected, totaling 4,026, and 326 declined to declare. In other words, the parent declined to declare citizenship. And we had 2,100 children who were rejected because there was not adequate documentation.
2,100?
Yes.
And what did we do when those that declined to declare, what happened to those?
They're rejected.
They're rejected, okay.
Yes. And I have that information for all of our program lines. I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
I think that would be good to have.
Well, let's just say that I were an illegal immigrant, and I had a child, and I lived in the same building or house as one who had a green card. And, of course, there's no birth records here. That person agreed to take my child in and say, this is my kid. I want him to be covered. Is there any way that you would be able to know that?
Our staff should be asking for documentation that proves that relationship, Senator. And whether that's a passport or that's some record from INS or whoever, you know, whatever records they might have to prove the relationship. Because our policy would be that we have to have sufficient documentation to show that they're a legal immigrant.
And do you believe that the people on the front line are following that policy?
I would hope that they are.
Do you have any mechanism to...
We do quality control reviews on our cases, and we look at eligibility determinations to determine across the board, did we have the right documentation, did we have the right income verifications. So we have a random sampling review that we do of our cases.
Okay. If someone gets pregnant, however, and comes in, they're going to get Medicaid no matter what they're, I'm assuming. Is that correct? A pregnant girl walks into your office and says, I need, or goes to a clinic and says, I need, aren't they pretty much automatically going to get Medicaid?
We do have a Medicaid program for pregnant women. There are eligibility.
Legal or illegal?
Now, again, I think I've even got maybe some stats on that with me. Right now, there are 836 legal immigrants, eligible immigrants, receiving that service. We have rejected 1,200. 83 declined to declare, so they were rejected. 617 failed to have proper documentation, so they were rejected.
We could have those numbers. I think the committee would like to have them.
Question, do you verify the documentation? I mean, somebody comes in, here's a document, looks real. Is there any way to prove that the documentation is or isn't real?
Our staff are going to look, like if they're looking at a passport, they're going to look for the seals and things like that, Senator. But I can't say that my staff are experts in identifying false documentation.
Do you think that having a biometric system like retina, you know, scanning might pick up, you know, a significant portion and create savings?
It's hard for me to say how many we miss. I don't know.
There's no way to know, is there?
If they had a doubt about a document, what would they do?
If they have reason to believe that the document is false, they're going to ask for secondary documentation or statements from people.
Okay. All right. Thank you. But we would kind of like that information, if you don't mind. Probably not doable.
You're talking about the one on page 19?
Actually, I think, yes, 19.
You know, I completely understand this. This person's concern, you know, and I talked earlier about perverse incentives that are built into the system. this is an example where this is a severely perverse incentive that we the people of Missouri are paying for out of some in part out of our general revenue. And what we need to be doing is, you know, the senator that was beside me earlier said that, you know, we don't need to legislate morality, but that's exactly what we've done by putting this perverse incentive into the system. And we need to stop legislating that particular morality and just simply require them to be responsible. I'm all about putting some kind of a limit or removing the perverse incentive. I don't know how to do it. Do you have any idea?
That's why I say doable. I don't know how you do it either.
It needs to be done.
So happy you're back.
I was informed that 2 p.m. we have to have all these problems solved because there's another meeting in here. So we're going to move right along. Wow, we're only on 20.
Thank you.
Okay, Child Abuse and Neglect, Children's Division, and local law enforcement are required to co-investigate allegations. Seems redundant and misuse of state resources. Any comments? Anyone here from that department? Is it a duplication? To have the Children's Division and local law enforcement co-investigate.
I believe that the focus of their investigations are very different. I come from the budget side, quite frankly, and from higher program side, so I don't know a lot about the child welfare program. I don't know. It's frankly also a good time I can introduce our new Children's Division director.
Does she have answers?
Candy Shively.
Do you have answers to this question?
But we can provide what they're looking for, the focus of that investigation of each, but I do believe they're looking for different things in the investigation.
You provide us,
I don't know if she has
you provide us the reasons why they do two separate ones, and we'll decide if it's something we need to look at. Awesome. The new health reform law provision is included to allow children of state employees to be enrolled in CHIP. Cost of MCHIP is about $2,000 a year. Cost for CHIP is about $800 less than that. This person says we can save $29 million if we send kids to CHIP instead of MCHCP.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
There's a logical flaw in this argument, and it's that the subset of kids that are on CHIP might be quite different than the subset of kids that would be on MCHCP, and you can't. It isn't logical to say that just because you take a child out of MCHCP and put them on CHIP that they would cost more or less.
Can we have the department give us a breakdown of the two different programs and who's and why they should be on each one of those? Okay, number 22, pillaging. I love it when they start with strong words. Okay, institutionalization, we're skipping that one, we've already covered it. And number 23, when you type in all caps, I can't read it. So if that's a good one, someone let me know. And it's on page 24, and page 25, and page 26. And apparently they hit the character limit on your email, and they've continued it on page 27, 28, 29. And 30, and 31... And 32. All right. Well, if someone wants to read that one and let me know what it means. Bruce? A little bedtime reading tonight?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. We'll have the Cliff Notes version in my office tomorrow at 9 a.m. Number 33. Supervisory personnel for DFS, mostly social service workers. Can we get information from DFS on the number of supervisory personnel, what percentage of that makes up your total personnel? And their average salary. And page 34 and 35. was the same person from. Welfare fraud generalization, we've kind of touched on it. Number 37.
Mr. Chair.
Go right ahead.
This one on welfare fraud, you know, I myself have kind of had some experience with this. I like to just...
You've committed welfare fraud?
No, I've talked to some people who, who've experienced this that are my personal friends. And friend of a friend?
Well,
let me explain. You know, I have a good friend who had several housing units. And he made the statement to me that, you know, of all the people that he had in his supported units, housing units, 85% of them were cheating on the calculation of household income by hiding the true fact that there was somebody else living there. And that's a form of welfare fraud. And so I was at this meeting, and there were three individuals from the department who were social workers, and their job was to ride herd on this. And I told them that story, and they said, oh, yeah, that's true. And we know who they are, too. But we're not allowed by the policy of the department to do anything because our job is to help these people. And I think they were from the Department of Social Services, although we learned earlier that they're not the ones who actually create the permission. So maybe what it is that there's one department is not talking to the other, and they're not turning them in. I asked this question at a meeting on a budget committee or something earlier last year, and was told that that's not true, that's not their policy. So I circled back and was told by one of these three individuals that it's not a written policy, but it's kind of an unwritten policy. I actually introduced a bill with a line in there, slipped a line into a bill that just said anybody who doesn't turn that in will be subject to losing their job. You know, this is the potentially a big deal. And, you know, if they did compute the live-in person's wages into there, we might have a whole lot of people who would no longer be on the program. I mean, we really need to focus our resources on people who really need it and not give it to people who game the system.
All right, skip ahead to page 39. Medicaid providers currently have 1 year to bill for services. Doesn't seem like good business practice. Most private businesses would not be able to operate efficiently this way. Recommend reducing the maximum amount of time to Medicaid providers to 6 months instead of the current year. Is that true? They have a year. Can it be changed to 6 months? Could we change it to 6 months? All right, page 39, you're getting back to us on. Does the state pay for funerals? Oh, is this for time off? Okay. Seriously? I know people who go to anyone's funeral just to get off work for that day. Apparently, maybe there are probably people out there like that. Can you please have someone in the department send us the funeral policy on when you can get a day's off for attending funerals? And can it be anyone's funeral, or does it have to be a family member? Child support enforcement. Can child support division, can you take a look at number 40, page 41, see if there's anything you can respond to in that one? That's revamping. Welfare is kind of general. Number page 43. Step parent income and Mo Health Net. We've covered that. They're getting back to us. Page 44. Institutional care, we're looking into that already. Page 45. This is a children's division staff. Page 47. I've seen this one twice, this theme twice. Does the department track generations of families that are receiving welfare benefits? So, grandpa got welfare, dad got welfare, and now I'm on welfare? Page 48, another institutional Bell Fountain Hab Center. Co-pays apply to Medicaid on page 49. Do we charge those, and what's the... Okay, it's coming. Awesome. Page 50. She learned how to not use all caps. This deals with child support and tax refunds. Okay. Page 51. Phone system that automatically disconnects phone calls after 10 minutes. Don't see the drastic savings in that one. Two. Family Support Division on training employees to do it on the internet or via web broadcast versus traveling. Family support, can you just send us an email what you guys spend on? Awesome. Sweet. Thank you. Yes.
One of the last sentence on this one talks about finding the cheapest prices instead of being mandated to purchase from certain companies. I think the state, are they not mandated to purchase from the state agency? And I've been told that there are cases where there are cheaper things available on the open market. And I was just wondering if we should maybe suggest a change in the law that would say either do it from the state agency or a cheaper vendor, something like that.
I've had some of those same complaints from state employees. However, I know that's in there to keep you from someone from going and buying from their brother-in-law or whatever. Not sure how you get around that, but I have had those same comments from state employees that they could buy whatever cheaper at Walmart than what they're getting it through the state. I've had that comment on a couple of occasions.
Well,
I don't know how you
information on that one, or
I don't even know who we'd have look into that. How we'd
well, I would think the department the OA. Would.
Anyone here from OA? Can you send this one to OA work group? Food stamp has a rule called simplified reporting. Participant does not have to report a change in their income. If the income does not go above a certain amount based on household size, thus income could go up, work, and income is disregarded until the next recertification period. Recertification is what, annual? And what is the simplified reporting? Is it what triggers it? I mean, we're looking at, you guys won't even entertain looking at it if it's less than a 15% change in AGI?
Yeah.
Okay. But you will look at it the next year? Okay. No. This is consolidation. Number 55. This nonprofit organizations. Okay. 56. This is really covering lots of different areas. We'll look at this one and see if... There's several different things there we can look at later. Number 60. Kind of deals with prisoners. We send this one over to the Task Force on Criminal Incarceration. Number 62, EMH Regional Offices. Okay, DMH Regional Offices. How many are there? 11. And who's housed there? How many of those are the quality assurance people? If you had to, are there regional offices that are predominantly for providing office space for quality assurance people? If we didn't have quality assurance people, would you need as many regional offices? So we could change the statute? We could. All right.
Mr. Chairman, question to inquire. This one specifically talks about the Albany Regional Center and the St. Joseph, I guess, branch office. So, you know, the thing is it's very clear that the population center is in St. Joseph, and the people, I guess, in St. Joseph, they don't have to drive to Albany because there's the St. Joseph office?
Yes.
Do you think that we need that regional office in Albany? What's your reasoning for not having it just in one place in the region? You don't want to have those people in Albany travel to... Thank you.
Have you looked at privatizing case management out there? Those three counties where there was SB40 boards, but you contracted with them. So now remember, we've discussed that in the past, haven't we? I thought so. 865. Page 66. I'm going to start just going through these, and you guys stop me if there's something you want to talk about.
Did you skip 65?
Yes. Page 68, for individuals with developmental disabilities who have ARO as payee, they never see their benefit money. NAFS are constantly being used to pay AB units for these individuals. They are being denied even things such as medical needs. Individuals are being singled out for the fact they have no one else overseeing their income. I feel this is unethical as the benefits they received are for their disability. It's number page 68. Can you guys take a look at it and see? I don't know what it means either. This is about forging scripts. 70.
Mr. Chairman, on page 69, this is something that I've seen before, and there's room here to save some money. The department oftentimes, when they find somebody that's cheating, they just, you know, recoup the money or whatever, and then they don't kick the person off for a real significant amount of time. You might want to look into that.
What is the length of time if you're caught scamming the system that you're denied benefits?
It depends on the benefit, but...
Can you get us a list of... Can you get us the policies on that? Thank you. Very good, Senator. Good I Spy. This is from some ideas from the steering committee. Mark that one. I'll look at that one later. And Mrs. Page 76, is there any financial impact to the state if we get rid of the Certificate of Need program? Or is that just a policy-based decision? Is there any fee, any income or revenue generated by this deal? Okay, policy decision. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
At the bottom of the Certificate of Needs handout, it said something on the order of, during its life inception... The CON program has prevented something like $10 billion worth of unnecessary construction in the state of Missouri. Well, $10 billion worth of construction would sure put a lot of people to work and generated a lot of income and revenue.
Mm-hmm.
This is something worthy of our consideration.
That's a policy decision, and... A good bill for you. Haven't you filed one on this before?
Senator Lemke has. Oh, and I have multiple years.
I thought so.
But, I mean, if our goal here is to identify policy decisions that would save money, this is sure.
But there's already legislation out there, Senator Lemke filed.
Sure.
All right. Why is Social Security disability determination a part of the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education? Is it?
Question.
Huh? Is
Question,
it?
Isn't it?
Is SSI disability determination a part of DESE? Yes, it is. Part of Voc Rehab. Okay. Do you guys do any SSI eligibility?
For example, we would apply as on behalf of that child for SSI eligibility, and frankly, the purpose of that is it provide if the child's eligible, they should be receiving it, and while the child's in care and custody, the money helps pay for their costs, and it's also a stable income for the family, and then we also do some work around Medicaid, Family Support does, and looking at determining people permanently and totally disabled. And that would be, I think, part of the information we'd be providing you on SSI in general and Medicaid.
So you're doing SSI disability determination for some programs, and DESE is doing it under Voc Rehab.
We do some work around for Medicaid, so that apparently must be the case. I know 2 or 3 years ago we did a pretty large presentation on what we do compared to what DESE does, and we could at least put some facts together.
You can find that presentation and let us know, and we'll take a look at why it's housed in two different places. Thank you. Okay, we got 20 minutes left here, and we're now in tab 2, which... one way to save money is to do away with the Division of Social Services modifications of child support. This person is saying that they can hire an attorney if they meet qualifications for modification. Usually the respondent hires an attorney to fight it, and then the case becomes a court case, causing all the work to be done by DSS to be a waste and having to be redone anyway. Why are we providing a free attorney to one parent for a civil action? Comments? Do they say to us we have to provide it, or can we just put a person in an office, say we provide it, and always have a busy signal? How severe are the sanctions? Let's check into that. The federal government says we have to have it, but could be possibly duplicative in the private sector in civil actions. Yeah, some information on that would be good. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Go right ahead.
On page 5, this is an excellent point, and I'm wonder, it has to do with court-ordered child support payment. Make sure that I guess it would be that the mother has requested this child support, or that somehow or another the fathers pay. And there, I'm aware of mothers who have said, you know, I'm not going to go after the child support, and consequently the state has to pay because now they qualify for Medicaid. Is there a way that we can get at that problem? Is it something within our ability as a state? So what would be interesting to know is how many single moms are on Medicaid and are or are not receiving child support, and what's the total amount? And then for those that aren't, how come?
Okay, let's go to tab 3. They're saying that the state of Missouri is one of few states that require non-emergency responders to be on call. Example, Children's Division, formerly known as DFS workers, on juvenile officers are currently on call. The state spends millions of dollars each year paying these state workers mileage overtime pay for being on call. However, other states such as Kansas do not have on-call workers unless you are an emergency responder such as firefighter, police, and detectives. Is that the case?
Are there many cases when maybe you get a call at 8 o'clock at night that you actually send somebody out? You don't go the next morning, maybe? that happen a lot?
Awesome. Thank you. Let's take a look at page 3. Go to a centralized dictation pool for children's division caseworkers to be able to do their reports. Presently, well over half the time, these professionals require a 4-year degree, but it's spent on basic clerical duties such as typing and filing. Thank you very much. Tab 4. Allow state employees who work in residential facilities to require around-the-clock supervision, i.e. Division of Youth Services, to work 3 12-hour days. Few workers would be needed per day, but the same level of care would be provided. How would the contact with the kids differ if it was 12-hour shifts or 10-hour shifts? So in your opinion, the 12 is too long, but 4 10-hour days is something you're experimenting with?
Yes.
Keep us updated on how that goes.
Well, and there's not really any cost.
Okay, then scratch that. Go to tab 6. Group home setting. Okay, page 3, this person's talking about HUD vouchers for people living in the community ISL programs. There's long waiting lists. If persons receiving DMH Medicaid waiver services were to apply for these vouchers, it could save the state of Missouri tons of money. However, there's no incentive for the service agencies to spend time and money to take people to apply for the vouchers. $40 million available right now in HUD vouchers, but no one to coordinate a complicated and long application process. DMH had someone coordinating this and case managers that help with the application process for these vouchers. It would be great. Commentary. Can the department get back to us on this? And just what they're talking about and... That was page 3 on tab 6. Okay. These, a lot of these are just please don't cut my program rather than an actual reboot type of an idea. That one's about rates for... Oh, yeah, DMH's Seymour automated system, which began development in 2000 and after 10 years and millions of dollars, is still not fully functional. We've heard this in appropriations several times. Is it fully functional yet? And
yeah, by the end of this... FY11, Brent McGinney, Department of Mental Health, all of our standalone legacy systems and CPS will be consolidated onto Seymour. So this, we're at the last stage here of getting Seymour to be the single system for DMH.
Because it's, I mean, it's been 11 years. Is it outdated now?
No, it's received several updates as it's gone on and under development. So it's still a web-based system, and we added PD this past fiscal year, and CPS is the last division to be brought online.
You're not going to ask for any money in appropriations for your system?
No.
For the next 11 years?
We should not be back for you for more money for Seymour, correct?
All right, number 13, the PACT proposal from the St. Louis Regional Health Commission that would transfer state operation of beds to a local hospital. Now, can you shed some light on that and what that is? Can you guys get back to us on that? Take a look at number 13 on tab 6, and we'd like commentary on those suggestions. Funding, tab 7. This deals with LIHEAP. Anyone here dealing with LIHEAP? Again. This is really dealing more with distributing the funds. See if the person owes money to the propane company. Or if a person is bankrolling state money. So what do you provide? A state grant to the local, and then they distribute the money out. So it's a local issue in their own. Yes.
On page 3, this is the second time I've seen one from someone who suggests charging people for the cost of making hotline calls when that are turned out to be frivolous. I wonder if there's anything there.
Do we know how many of the calls come into the hotline are deemed frivolous? What percentage? And the number of calls? And if you don't know, you can just tell us and get back to us. Thank you. Tab 8. This is a staffing thing through attrition. Incorporate the Division of Employment Security with the Family Assistance Programs. This would allow those filing for assistance to apply for employment at the same time, reducing our welfare rolls. Division of Family Services would feel more compelled to find employment for their patrons rather than retaining them on welfare rolls as job security for DFS. That actually kind of makes some sense. Flag this one. It's another child abuse hotline. We're getting information on that one. That's what you were talking about, right? Kind of like verification. Tab 8. Make each employee that gets reimbursed for food and other expense to turn in a receipt. I would assume that all departments, if you get a you have to turn in a receipt and make documentation. I would think that most everybody would, and if that's not the case, someone let me know. It's a per diem thing? Okay. How many agencies get per diem besides the legislature? Pardon me? Send this one to OA. Ask them to, or to the group dealing with OA. Ask them to comment on it. Thank you. What's the maximum amount of money a family can get on food stamps per month? Can you get that to us? Can you just give us the chart of what they can get? I think they're buying. I think they're buying junk food and then turn around and using their cash, their own money to buy. Which now with the EBT cards, they just swipe them and they don't get change back. It just stays on the card. But there's no health value on anything. Okay. Tab 10. This one deals with eligibility and estate planning. Tab 11. This deals with Mo Health Net residency. Sorry, we were still on tab 10. Mandatory drug test for welfare benefits seems to be dominating tab 11. Yep. Every single one of them. All right. We do have a handful of them that were handed out at the very end. Which I'll take a look at and see if any of those warrant. Do we need any more information? Well, thank you for all the departments of getting information back to us. I think there's a handful of things here that we could get information on. If anyone has any other information you would like to discuss with me privately, if you didn't want to bring up in the middle of the program, please come up and visit me in 418? On the fourth floor. Thank you very much.